sabrosura pa ti, keke.
Hello, everyone. This is Bum, the Café con Bum, the bilingual podcast that features Latine and people of the global majority who break barriers, change lives, and make this world a better place. Today, we have a conversation with Marisa Ibarra Williams. Marisa is a partner at a prestigious law firm in Texas, where she routinely represents some of the largest companies in the country. After attending the best law school in Texas and landing her first job, she naively believed the struggle was over. The road to success, however, was anything but easy. Over the course of the last 20 years, she's encountered numerous challenges, barriers, and obstacles. Through it all, she learned to lean on her faith, culture, uniqueness, and embrace the parts of her that should have been an impediment. She now uses her years of experience to empower women to tap into their voice, take back control, and lean into the powerful women they were given to be. Listeners, this conversation with Marisa was really cool because she talked about how she grew up as a border kid. We really dove into being a binational type of human because the border culture experience and the experience of living in a border town. Like, I live in San Diego, that's considered a border city. That is a border city. And we really dove into the various ways that one can exist in their humanity when it comes to living between two countries. It's quite fascinating. Y bueno, sin más, aquí está mi conversación with Marisa Ibarra Williams. Marisa, welcome to Café con Pam.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. So the first question that we always ask is, what is your heritage?
Mexican American. My entire family's from Mexico.
And you're in Texas.
I am. Shocking, right?
Well, I'm in California. So.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Now, you grew up in the border of Mexico and the U.S. How was it for you to have this border town life? Because it's very different. I'm from Mexico City. Mm-hmm. And when I came to San Diego, it was kind of shocking to see how people would be like, oh, I'm going to Mexico. And I'm like, what? Like, you don't need to pack, you know? Like, to me, I was like, it's a trip. And they're like, no, we'll be back. We're just going to go get tacos and we'll come back. How was it for you to grow up that way?
Well, you know, the interesting part is I actually went to school in Juarez, Mexico, which is our border city. So I started there when you're potty trained. So like two and a half through sixth grade. So every day we would drive across the bridge and come back on the bridge. And really had no clue that that was, I mean, I knew it was Mexico, but until I became an adult and started traveling to the interior more, didn't kind of realize that that wasn't like normal, that you just kind of, you know, go to Juarez every day.
That you're crossing borders.
Yeah. Like, you know, and I would just say American when I came back, right? I didn't have passports. I mean, like back, this is, you know, gosh, 80s, right? So it was just a very different deal completely, but we literally crossed the border every single day for the first part of my life.
Yeah, my mom talks about that. My mom also lived in Juarez, and she often talks about, like, you know, we would just, like, literally wake up and go to school.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like and it was like nothing. It's like, oh, you just park here in 5 minutes, we'll be there, no problem. See you in a bit.
For sure. And it's fascinating how the migration, immigration conversation has evolved and shifted now to me, and I am curious about your experience and opinion, me living in a border town, in a border city, talking to people that don't and have zero idea of how the border works, it's really interesting because you can immediately tell with their opinions, you're like, yeah, you literally have no clue.
Exactly. Well, and here it's just, you know, it's also evolved, right, over time, the way immigration has happened. But it was perfectly normal, you know, to us. And it wasn't a big deal. And like El Paso is constantly ranked one of the safest cities. And so over time, right, that's kind of changed. And I get a lot of questions because I travel around the country for work, and their perception of what is happening here is very different than the reality. Mm-hmm. And I used to spend time like educating people, and then I realized it really didn't matter too much what I said. They had a kind of preconceived notion, and they were like, oh, that's interesting, but it wasn't going to change their mind. So I'd come up with like shorter responses to it because it really was just an icebreaker. They weren't that interested to really know what it's like and why it's not what they see in images. So it's been interesting to see that evolution because I've been practicing 15 years from where I started to now, that conversation has evolved. And what clients say to me and what witnesses say to me is really fascinating. Going from like, man, I've seen this evolution like up close and personal.
Super interesting for sure. So let's talk about your life. So you grow up in this border, cross-border, binational environment. So you went to school in Juarez. Were you living in the U.S.?
Yes, we lived here in El Paso. Yeah, so my parents, right, when they were growing up in El Paso, it was still segregation, right? Still where it was like no dogs, no blacks, no Mexicans, like that kind of environment. Get hit with the ruler if you speak Spanish. So they were clear as a united front that when they had children, they wanted their children to learn the full Mexican culture and history. Like this was like their rebellion, right? Against like what their life had been. And so, you know, we didn't know the difference, right? We had no idea. We had like shared rides with people who were doing the same thing. So we had no idea that there wasn't like all these other vans that had all these other kids. But they made, so like technically my first language is Spanish. I could only read and write phonetically when I came to the U.S. for school because all I knew was how to read and write in Spanish, you know, technically.
I've also heard interviewed people on the opposite side of that, where their parents, when they were hit and spanked from speaking Spanish, they were like, we're not going to learn that. Like our children are not going to go that route because we've experienced what's like to be different. And so there's the other side also of assimilation where people are like, all right, we're just going to get as close as we can to the dominant demographic by forgetting our original language, by forgetting our roots, by not eating the food, by like all the things. And so it's really interesting to see how different people react different.
Yeah. Well, and I should say they were probably that my parents were like activist people. So they were chaining themselves to their colleges and, you know, out there protesting and, you know, they are those people, you know? So for them, this was like, you're not going to tell me how to live my life.
Right.
I'm going to teach my kid. Not only am I going to teach my kids, they're going to go to school there and they're going to learn for themselves everything about their culture. So, yeah.
So how was it for you then to come to the U.S. school and then experience your own way of not fitting in a way? Because you could only read phonetically.
Well, you know, it was, I always knew that there was like a little something different, you know, because I kind of didn't exactly fit in when I was in school in Mexico, right? In Juarez, didn't exactly fit in here. Mm. And Juarez, as a matter of fact, my mom tells a story that she got called into the principal's office to kind of get in trouble because I was watching all the telenovelas and they were catching me talk about the telenovelas. I didn't watch telenovelas. I just heard everybody and I got
making up.
I would listen to what they said and I would know enough of the story that I could repeat it so I would seem like them. Right? Like that was my way of trying to fit in there. And then here, we didn't even know how to do. So like in Mexico, when they have their anthem, you kind of hold your hand more like military style. That is not the way you do it here. And my mom tells another story. We went to a parade and the Mexican army kind of came out as part of the parade. It's typical here. And that my brother and I were like, mi bandera, mi bandera. And we got to salute, right? And then when the U.S. military came, we looked around, like I looked around and I saw that's not how people were holding their hand, and I put it down. Right. So I think that it was instinctively, not knowing it then, I learned to be really observant to the situation around me and figure out how to adapt.
Yeah. I think it's a survival mechanism that all of us kind of have to adopt to adapt, is walking into places and spaces and be like, all right, how could I get myself closer to what's accepted?
Yes. And not stick out, right, so much, right? It was one of those, like, how do I write this line authentically, but how do I write this line? And understanding that there was these distinctions, right? There was differences. Some of them mattered, some of them didn't. But kind of learning that self-awareness, I think I ended up learning at a young age, like just kind of as a result of the circumstance.
For sure. How old were you when you came to school back to the U.S.?
So it would have been sixth grade. So I was 13 when I started high school because I skipped a grade. Interestingly enough, even though it was a different language and they did testing, I could have gone from sixth grade to freshman year. And my mom wouldn't let me. Because in Mexico, it was a Montessori school. So it was a very different system than the switching classes thing that happens in the U.S. She's like, little girl, you don't know this system. Like, you don't even know what you're doing. No. So she let me skip seventh. So I did eighth grade here. And then I started high school and I was 13.
That's a tough age.
Yes. And I was technically failing English. Because, right, I told you I can only read and write phonetically. And I spoke perfect English because at home I would speak English. At school I would speak Spanish. So they didn't think I needed like ESL or something like that necessarily. But I had to like I was failing English in eighth grade because I was like, what are these I before E except after C? Like in Spanish, how it sounds is how it is.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, what are you talking about? So it was a tough transition. Some of those aspects were really, really difficult. I remember that.
And what was going on in Marissa's head at that age? Of like, did you ever question, go back to your parents and be like, why did you do this? Like, why didn't we take like the quote easy path and just put me in a school in the U.S. since the beginning?
No, I think at that time, I really, it was more so a matter of like this is just what you got to do. You know, like, it's like, okay, I'm failing. And I was like, I didn't like failing. I didn't like how it felt. So I was honest about when I needed help and when I was struggling. But it never really occurred to me like that there was like a questioning of why is it this way? It was like, okay, like if I'm failing, then I better figure out how to pass. Like, you know, so and I think that's kind of just held true through my life. It's like, okay, you just got to get it done now. So what do we got to get done? And it wasn't until later that I started like even appreciating the difference or appreciating that like all my friends didn't have this experience. This was not typical. This was not happening the way that I thought it was happening. And maybe then I might have thought about it, but in the moment, it never even occurred to me.
Mm. And so how do you go from failing English to saying, I want to become a lawyer?
It was a very messy road, first of all. I'll tell you, one of the things that sometimes I think about to myself is I went from failing English in eighth grade to being in AP classes in high school.
Mm.
And it's something that I remind myself of even today, sometimes when I'm facing really difficult things, like, wait a minute, girlfriend, you didn't even know the language. Okay. We can deal with it. Right. We can get there. Mm-hmm. And in high school, I learned, I took speech and debate as a class. Right. And I loved it. And so I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. And I was like speech and debate champ. I was all over it. And everyone told me I was going to be a lawyer, except me. Because I didn't see any lawyers that looked like me, that talked like me, that were messy like me. The people that I thought were going to be lawyers had it together, honey. They had the straight A's. They were, you know, they were everything but what I was. So I fought. I didn't go to law school till I was 27 years old. because of having to work through my own stuff about, am I that person? You know, can I be that person? Can I really be that in life? So that's why I said it was a really messy ride.
Yeah, we're going to dissect it. What did you go to undergrad for?
So I did political science as undergrad. So I told you my parents were kind of activist folks. So we used to ditch school technically. Like I knew this later. I just thought, you know, we took the day off on election day and we would be like outside of polling places with signs. And on weekends we would block walk with our parents because they don't close the door in kids' faces. And so politics and government was just always present in my family. Like to this day, my dad still helps with the elections department. My mom ran for office, you know, so it was just part of our culture, our family dynamic. So I ended up doing poli sci because I was like, oh, this is like, right. I thought I was going to do politics is what I thought, like campaign management. I worked for President Clinton on his campaign. And so I thought, oh, I'll just go into that. I really didn't know at the time that I would find my way to law school.
How did that happen? So someone planted the seed and they were like, multiple people were saying like, Marissa, you need to become a lawyer. But then, you know, there was this self-doubt.
Yes. So it started off with, so I did campaigns, you know, for... I left home when I was 18. I did campaigns for like the next 4 years. And what would keep happening is when you work on someone's campaign and they lose the reelection, then the new administration comes in, you don't always get to keep your job. Mm-hmm. Right? Right. And the first thing that happened was that happened. The person I was helping didn't win. And they had given me 4 years of life experience as a substitute for college. Right? The new administration was like, everybody can keep their job as long as you meet the requirements as they are. So there I went, right? And I've learned that when I get mad, that's probably my best motivation. And I was like, this, I can't keep doing this. What happens if like the next person I work for does this and I still don't have a college degree and I still am in the same position? So I was like, you know what? Going back home. And I'm going to knock this out so they can stop firing me. I was like, and once I got there, I actually took a law class because they had one. And they had this amazing program here at UTIP. It's called the Law School Preparation Institute. And they give you like 2 summers worth of like, this is kind of what law school would be like. And they help you prepare for the LSAT. And I just did it kind of because my counselor said it might be a good idea. I still wasn't convinced. But once I did that, I really liked the challenge or the intellectual, you know, kind of rigor in it. And it was fascinating to me. And then I was like, hey, maybe I can do this. Like, maybe I'll just go and do it. Maybe I'll just try. And they had all the support built in. So the parts of it that were really intimidating, I had support for. Right, because they helped you kind of put your package together. But it was really more so of just being present and like listening to counselors and dibbling and dabbling, like just trying something here or there. And then once I got the bug, then I was like, okay, I'm really going to go for it. This is what I'm doing.
How was it to navigate then law school? Because you're 27. Probably there's, you know, people that are younger than you. Probably people that have, you know, parents who are lawyers or, you know, whatever. And so how was for you to get into another place of not belonging?
It was really, really tough. So I got into the best law school in Texas. Probably actually thankful to my variety of experience, right? It actually helped me get in. But when I got there, like people that had, you know, perfect LSAT scores and perfect GPAs and had done everything right and operated at a different level than I did were sitting right next to me. And Latinas, not very, you know, I'd say, I bet you it's the same kind of like as lawyers, like 2%, 3% of the law school population. Latinos, maybe 6, right? Then we had other people of color, and we'd all kind of congregate, and maybe now we make about 10%. But when you're sitting in that space, man, imposter syndrome goes off like crazy. I don't think I felt more stupid than those 3 years, because it was not black and white. It was shades of gray. And they were really teaching you how to think and analyze, but they don't tell you it directly. So you just feel really dumb a lot of the time. Like, there's some people, I know people who loved law school, right? They just, and I was like, no, honey, it was really tough for me. Like, I sat, there was many days, probably every day I wondered, oh my God, what am I doing here? How did I get here? Can I make it out of here? And it was really, really, really tough for me.
Was there ever a moment where you were like, I don't know if this is for me anymore?
Plenty. probably every finals, right? Every time we had finals, I was like, oh my God, what did I do? Because you have to learn all of the law. So it's not like you get to go to law school and say, I would just like to focus, like in college, on these things. You have to learn, and they tell you to take, you know, like the bar exam tests 21 areas of law. So they tell you take as many of those as you can. So when you go for the bar, it's not so foreign. But a lot of it is stuff that I don't use every day and I don't like. And every time some of those classes, I was like, oh my God, what am I doing here? But like I told you about, you know, when I was younger, I was like, you just got to do it. You just got to do it. And now I have student loans, right? I did also have scholarships. But like, I'm in it now. Like, there is no turning back. So at the very least, I was like, we are finishing and we are getting this JD. Even if we're crying all the way through, but we are getting it done. You know what I mean? Because now it's like it got real and it was too many consequences. And we just had, I just wanted to finish at the time, like really.
For sure. Did you have any mentors or champions who saw more in you than you could at the time? That kind of like pushed you through this?
You know, not so much that pushed me through it. Yes, there were tons, first of all, right? Everybody that would meet me, you know, my parents, friends, they were like, honey, this, the, you know, the sky's the limit, right? They saw all kinds of things that I could not see. Because in my head, every time they'd say that, I'd be like, yeah, but you don't know what a mess I am, right? You don't know how messy I can be. You don't know how, what the thoughts are in my head, right? I would immediately be like, you don't know all the things that would make you change your mind. Right? Like, it was just my natural reaction for the longest. But actually, seeing my family, so I'm the first and only, I'm the first female attorney in my mom's family. I'm the only attorney in my dad's. And that actually was way more powerful of a motivator than anything else, because making them proud, and like my grandmas were so proud. You know, really, my whole family was. I mean, they were just like beaming. To this day, they still are. They want to come see my trials, right? That was real for me. I really wanted to do it for them. I really wanted them to see their granddaughter or their cousin, you know, or their niece do something that no one had done before.
I love that. That's a great motivator. And I think a lot of us kind of like have that of becoming the person our parents came to be.
Yeah, that was the biggest motivator, because when I didn't, like I've also learned that I don't do things often for myself as much for others, but it absolutely will motivate me past my own limitations and my own voice in my own head that tells me all those other things. And they really were. I was like, I can't let them down. I can't let them down. Like, you got to do it.
You've talked about a couple times about being messy. Tell me more about that.
So in my mind, to be a lawyer, you kind of had to be perfect, right? You have to speak proper English. You have to have great grammar. You had to not curse. You know, you had to be like this, like almost like a Barbie picture. You know what I mean? Like if they had like lawyer Barbie, that was the image in my head. Is like you had to be a certain kind of person. And in my mind, I didn't like English wasn't my first language. I'm not the best necessarily at grammar. Apparently I can write, but I didn't really see it that way. I didn't know the history the way that people did here. I didn't know all the philosophers the way they did here, right? Because of all of these other life experiences. So in my mind, this checklist that a lawyer should have, I didn't meet most of those checks. And so that's why I say it was messy. And I was partying with my friends on the weekends, you know, and I was drinking when I shouldn't. And I was doing all those things, right? That in my mind, the people at school that I saw and I thought were going to be lawyers were not doing that.
But were they having fun though?
I had tons of fun. And I have no regrets either. But I, you know, I would, you would hear me on the announcements on Monday morning after seeing me at a party on Saturday night, you know. But that was truly who I, like, that was me. It just was me. But I had just decided that to be a lawyer, you had to be like this perfect person that did everything right.
Knowing what you know now and having been practicing law for a long time now, what would you say to that Marissa who was like, you have to be perfect?
Say, girl, you are so wrong. you know, it's really fascinating just how much we limit ourselves, not by even what other people tell us, but just the voice in our own head. I'm helping raise my stepdaughter now, and sometimes I tell her things and I tell her the positive parts about her. And I literally say to her, I'm saying this to you. So when you tell yourself the things you do in your own head, you have new material. Mm. And that's really, you know, I wish I knew then, right, what I know now, because I stopped myself. I limited myself, not because of even other people, and that was hard enough, but just because of what I could say to myself and my own voice, and I know how to say it in a way that gets to me, right? Like, just like we all have those people that can just say something and it cuts you to the bone. I was the best at putting myself down. I just was. And so I wish I had other material. I wish I would have listened to the people that were giving me the other material that I couldn't hear at the time.
For sure. Well, you can now.
that's part of what this is to me now. It's kind of like I remember that too much. And if I can help anyone not have to wait all that time or spend all those years in that space, it's worth it.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick coffee break. So, Marissa, do you drink coffee?
I don't, actually. I'm more like a tea person.
I know. What?
Everyone thinks I'm a
lawyer that doesn't drink coffee.
I get that every single time. Like, we'll go, like, this is – so I walk into depositions with that. I walk into trial with that, and people just look at me like, where's your coffee? And I started joking with people. I said, I'm on 10 anyway. Do you really want me on coffee?
You know? Right. I don't need coffee.
Right. But I love chai tea.
Nice.
There's just something about it that makes me warm and fuzzy inside.
And it's black tea, so you do get the caffeine kick.
Yeah. You know, so sorry. But yeah, everyone, especially lawyers, right? You can imagine, like, we have coffee brewing all day long at our law office.
Yeah. Lawyers, coffee's your blood.
And so everyone looks at me like, what? I was like, I'm sorry. I never liked the taste. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
I support that. There's, you know, there's a hot beverage for everyone. In your case, it's chai. I love
exactly. I find my way. You know, I'm like, I love this. It works for me.
Yeah, for sure. Do you make chai every day?
I do actually have pods. You know, now they have the Keurig pods. And I have the syrups. I do the whole thing.
Nice. Yeah. Do you have a coffee shop or a tea shop that local that you support?
I used to have one. It was called Dolce Vita, and it was my favorite. It was like the quintessential coffee house, like had like cozy lighting, cozy seats. Like, it was my me time. And then they closed it. And now we have a bunch of chains. I think there's Café Nopal. That's the closest kind of thing. But the one that I really loved, that really had that vibe to it, they closed it down. I think it closed down around COVID.
Yeah. Unfortunately, so many businesses closed during the pandemic. And
yeah,
you know, there's this like sadness around it. But
especially when they were small, I think, you know, like the for real small businesses, I think a lot of them really, I'll be interested to see those stats one day, but really great places that just couldn't make it through that time.
Yeah, no, the pandemic broke a lot of businesses for sure. But hopefully they'll regain and come back.
I would love them to.
Yeah. On my end, I'm drinking tea, actually, because it's that time of the morning. It's still morning, but I've already had my 2 cups of coffee, and I have been teaching a lot, which my throat is kind of like, oh, I need some support. So I drink my 2 cups of coffee in the morning, and then mid-morning, I drink tea, and I am drinking from Tadin Teas. This is not sponsored yet, but I do love their, this is still a pumpkin cinnamon. So I combine them. I combine teas. So this is pumpkin cinnamon and ginger. So I have a bag of pumpkin cinnamon tea, and then I added a bag of ginger tea just because I like to blend flavors. And it's delicious. And it's a great mid-morning kind of like.
And it's called Tadin?
Tadin, T-A-D-I-N.
I'm going to have to check it out because I do. I love teas, especially when you can brew them too. Like, I mean, I do the pods just because of convenience, but mm-hmm. I kind of would love to experiment with some different bags and do my own little blend.
I do that a lot. I used to be, when I was in college, I used to drink tea all the time, actually. I'm a first tea person and then coffee. And then I'm a recovering procrastinator, so I started procrastinating on stuff, and tea wouldn't cut it anymore. And people were like, why don't you drink coffee? Because that will keep you awake. And I'm like, let's go. And so that's when I got into coffee in college. But I was the tea person first.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah.
That probably would have helped me some actually, now that I think about it.
Some coffee.
I just was like, I don't like the taste, you know, and that was the deal breaker. Like, there was no more conversation. Yeah. But now as you say that, it's like, oh, that might have helped me some of those nights.
Because coffee is an acquired taste, you know, it's not like, I totally understand why people are like, this is gross. Like my partner, he would never, like he's had coffee once in his life and he was like, this is disgusting. And so I understand, you know.
And you have to add so much stuff to it, right? Like to make it taste good. And then I was like, oh my God, how much sugar is this? What am I adding? Right. Then I start spinning and I was like, never mind.
Yeah. I mean, arguably, I would say good coffee doesn't need anything.
Ah, then I haven't had good coffee. I can say that with authority.
I'd support that statement, actually. So, yeah, I think it's definitely an acquired taste. And oh, what I was going to say in college is before I got into coffee, I was drinking, and this is like so bad. I don't know if I actually want to say it. I was drinking Baja Blast from Taco Bell.
Oh my God, those big old drinks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like caffeine, like, and sugar overload. But then I was like, you know, this is way too, like, I realized that my body was like, what are you doing? This is like way too much sugar, way too much, like all at once, like, mm-mm. And so then I got into coffee and I was like, okay, this at least is warm because I'm always cold too.
And with whipped cream and all kinds of stuff now.
Right?
Yeah.
Much funner. Much more fun. Okay. Well, let's get back to the show. Listeners, as you know, I'm a recovering procrastinator, and because of that, I'm often building ways to getting things done. Inside the annual Manny's Pass, we get to embrace our own unique ways of achieving. Together, in our weekly office hours and cafecitos, we'll find strength in our differences, accountability in our goals, and power in our voices as we heal our inner child through coaching and tapping. Your choice. Let's redefine productivity on our terms. Visit cafecompam.com/Manny's Pass and join us. Marissa, so you finished law school. How do you decide which arm of law are you going to go into?
So again, when I get angry, things happen. So I go to my law school counselor, who's supposed to help me with job placement. And after 3 years in law school, I had a lot of debt. Okay. I had a lot of debt, and they kept talking about going to work for big law firms because they would pay you like good money, like really good money. That had never been an interest, but then I'm just looking at life, right? I got all these student loans to pay. What am I going to do? And I go to the counselor and I tell her like, hey, how do I start this process? What do I do? And in short, she won't help me because I don't have the parents that are partners at a law firm. I don't have the pedigree. From her perspective, you know, my grades weren't high enough to make the cut. And she literally told me, honey, why don't you just go back home? You know, the DA's office or legal aid would love to have someone from UT there.
Wow.
Yeah. I was so livid. I walked out of there and I was crying. Like, and I don't get mad very often. I was like mad crying and I'm calling my parents.
Like angry tears?
Yes. Like I could have punched through a wall, but I'm crying. Like I'm almost like hysterically crying because I cannot believe she just said that to me.
Yeah.
And I'm telling my parents about it. And I'm like in the moment, I feel like all our history like just hits me at the same time. Like, are you kidding? Like we're supposed to be somewhere else in life. And that's all you see when you see me. I mean, I was gone. And, but because of that, I then decided I was for sure going to go work at a firm. And I was going to show her that she was wrong about me and my capabilities.
Okay.
And I started doing this research and found out that the big companies, right, the Fortune 100s, Fortune 500 companies, hire the best law firm in the jurisdiction where the cases are filed. And so I was like, okay, let me look back home, right, and see if there's those kind of firms back home. And sure enough, you know, we had, you know, a handful of law firms that represented very large companies. And I thought, okay, I'll start there. Let me see what happens there. Because my cousin is a lawyer, and he had gone to work for a big firm but hated it, the type that he went to. And I was like, okay, let me try something else. And went and interviewed with them. And the first law firm I worked for, the attorney told me that he would give me any opportunity I wanted as long as I showed him I was capable and that I had done the work. And he did represent some of the biggest companies in the country.
Wow.
So it was kind of intentional, kind of not, and kind of responsive to this person not being willing to help me, really.
For sure. I love that. And so once you find yourself in this big law firm, do you still feel the imposter that your early law student self felt? Or at this point, it's like, no, we got this.
No. You know what I felt? I think like in the moment, I still wasn't sure I had what it took, truthfully. But I was willing to put in the work. And so I spent a lot of time teaching myself things. I spent a lot of time at the office, weekends, nights, kind of over-preparing for everything because I was so insecure that perhaps I wasn't good enough, that I just thought I had the discipline and the hard work to, you know, at least do what was required or what was necessary. And that's really how I powered through all those moments was I would put in, like, even as we stand here today, if I get a new case that I know nothing about in a new industry, I know that I will put in the work to figure it out and I will find the resources I need to become who I need to become for that case. But it was a huge struggle for me because all of those imposter syndrome, limiting beliefs, they were right there with me every single day.
And would you agree? And I notice this a lot in my clients who are all Latinas. I feel like we naturally do that, which is because we feel in a way, in our own way, inadequate for the job, we overwork in hopes that the extra work, you know, it's like the extra credit is going to get us further.
1,000%. That is still what I do today. I like to sit here and pretend like, oh no, honey, I made it. We're good. That is still what I do.
Yeah.
Like I will say, depending on your field, it does tend to help you because you distinguish yourself from other people because not everyone is putting in that work, putting in that time, putting in that investment, and you are.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And I'm going to challenge that a little bit because I think, yes, we get further. And I think at the same time, we need to also own our hard work because many times, and I speak for myself and I speak for like the people that I work with, we work so much harder and it's almost like we don't even value the harder work. It's like, was I had to do it because that's kind of like how I work all the time, you know? Like, how could we get to that place where we say, and I'm a damn good hard worker that will make it happen, that will find the resources, will find the way no matter what, because I'm that good. Like, how could we own the resourcefulness, the strength, the grit, and the extra credit that we always work for?
You know, that's a great question. It's kind of, I feel like that's kind of the space in time that I'm at in my life now. Is after, you know, doing this for 15 years and in every state they have this list that's called super lawyers. And when you're a young attorney, only 2.5 of the population that's of attorneys is eligible. When you're an older attorney, of up to 5% of the lawyer population in that state is eligible. But it's like peer reviewed, researched. You can't buy your way on this list. And when I was young, when I first came out and I wanted to make sure people knew that I wasn't just a diversity hire and it wasn't just because of some superficial reason that I was hired, but that I was good and maybe, and the best actually, I told myself I was going to be on this list. Right. And I got, and now I can with authority say I've been on this list most of my career. And now, yeah, like after having that, that's kind of the space and time where I'll have a client and they're treating me kind of the way people used to treat me when they weren't sure, you know, who I was or what I was capable of. And I do find myself owning like, no, I've been in this for 15 years. I've handled cases bigger than this, more complicated than this, harder than this, and made miracles happen. I do got this. But it took me 15 years to get there, truthfully.
I love that. And thank you for sharing that because I think also Latinas are always looking for models. And many times context is often skipped in hopes that we give that authority of like, well, look at where I've gotten, you can get here. And people need context to say, well, you weren't always there. Thank you for sharing the space, the in-between bridge that you had to go through to get to that place. Because sometimes models could look so far away that people get discouraged. So thank you for sharing all that context.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I, even when I do like speaking, because I do like women empowerment speaking, I always tell them that, like, people see me here today and they think it's been this way the whole way through. It has not. And it's still not even that true today. Like, I still have people who question me and who still treat me certain kind of ways and still only see what they see when I'm assigned to their file. But who I have become is different. What I own is different. And what I've done, and kind of like standing on top of what I've done, I can say it differently now. But it's always something that I tell them, like, do not mistake where I am today as where I started, or that somehow I don't remember what that road is like, because I still live that road today. I just handle it differently.
I love that. Totally. Totally. And yeah, so many thoughts on that. But talk to me about the pivoting. So you talk about the power of the pivot.
Yeah. So it was something that I started. So like I tell you, right, because I overwork and I would deal with clients who had like never even had a Latina or a person of color as an attorney before. You can imagine that there were some spaces, some rooms, some meetings, some clients that were more difficult than others to kind of navigate.
I'm sure you have stories.
Yeah. And I was like, and I was doing everything I could, right? So I'm working on the industry. I'm doing all this extra work that we know we do. And I know that I'm doing everything I can to be something different or to show them that I'm worthy or that I'm valuable or that actually they're in the exact right hands. And I started getting really, really frustrated and resentful and kind of angry. Like, why, despite the fact that I'm on all these lists and I'm getting all these awards and I've done all these things, like, why can't you see me for me? Like, see me for more, you know, take me seriously, you know, just whatever, you know, just any part of that. And I kept looking externally, right? And tried everything I could get my hands on, right? Any kind of self-help book there was, any industry book, any lawyer book, I was reading it all, and nothing got deep enough for me. Because what I learned was I needed a different way to relate to myself, to others, to life, to what was happening. And that's when I started tapping into and kind of becoming more aware of the power of pivoting and how it actually allowed me to always take control back and take control back of the narrative and the situation in a way that didn't rely on anyone and no one else could take it from me.
Since we're running out of time, I have so many more questions, but tell us where we can find you, all the places and spaces where we can
find
you.
So the best place to find me is Success with Marisa, and it's MARISA.com. That's kind of my hub. So I've created this website. It's successwithmarisa.com. And it's where I'm linking everything up, right? So that way it's kind of a one-stop shop. My socials are going to be linked in there so people can go to the socials. But it also has the programs that I'm working on. So I have the Power of Pivoting and Introduction. It's going to have the link to that program. And then the Power of Pivoting, the comprehensive course, which will be this summer, and it'll be linked there. But I also created a journal. It's an 8-week motivational journal that just really was something that I was doing when I was in this process of figuring out how to take back my life and what I was seeing and how I wanted to relate to it. And so that is also going to be linked into that site. So it's kind of the mother hub for anything. And people can also book me for speaking engagements through that site. But that'll give you, and it
great
links my interviews, you know, different presentations. So it's like the little mother hub of anything Marisa. And I think it's the best way, if anybody's interested in any facet of what I do or what I offer, they can find it there.
I love that. And so present Marisa, like la de Marisa de hoy, you're a partner now at your firm.
I am.
How does that feel knowing that at some point you almost wanted to not do law school?
Right. Knowing that I told myself not to do law school. Yeah. Well, you know, I was super fortunate. I made partner, gosh, I think it was like 6 years into my career, which is pretty unheard of.
Nice.
So I've been partner most of my legal career now. And I think the moment that kind of like got me was not so much when I became partner as much as when I started learning that people who have been practicing longer than I had were not. Or like that not everybody that's a good lawyer ends up on super lawyers. Like there's amazing attorneys that I know that are not on that list. And that was more of a current day Marisa getting it than anything else, because when you're doing it, you're just doing it, right? I was just working hard. I was trying to get there. I'm just trying to do my job, trying to do it well, and didn't really stop to think much But when I hit the 15-year mark, it's kind of made me look back a little. And then I was like, can you believe this? Like, how did we get here? And that's what propelled me kind of now with all these programs and speaking engagements was, man, I almost cost myself my own life, my own success because of what I used to tell myself.
Oof.
And it got to my core when I really saw that. It's like, oh my God, I could have cost myself this life I've created out of what I was telling myself and what version of me I was living into. And that's when I was like, yeah, I was like, no, we are not living that way. And if there's anything I can do to help people not stay in that space for longer than they absolutely have to, we're going to do that now because that is not okay.
100%. Because how many times do we see people with incredible talents and the inner narrative that's driving them? It's the opposite, you know, like potential is there and we can't fall in love with the potential of people. People have to fall in love with their own potential. So I love that you do that with your work now.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. Absolutely.
So last few questions, because we are running out of time. Do you have a remedio that you want to share with us?
You know what? I think actually the best remedy I have, and actually it's consistent, because anytime I am struggling, I go out running. It's not fast. I am a very slow runner. Okay. But I have my favorite playlist and I have different playlists for different reasons, but there's something about being out in nature and the smells and the feeling and by yourself that every single time I'm struggling, or even when I'm getting ready for closing arguments or opening statements in a case or a deposition or something that's heavy and real, that my husband will know that part of I must be in the middle of something because all of a sudden I'm running every single day.
Mm.
So whatever that is for people, like there, find your you time, your you space.
I love that.
Because your body needs it. You know, your mind needs it to clear your mind and see through things.
Yes. Movement, body movement, whatever form that works. Yeah, it shifts your nervous system for sure. And do you have a quote or mantra that you live by?
Bet on me.
Short and sweet.
Bet on me. Anytime I'm scared and I'm trying something new and I'm putting myself out there, or I have something that I don't think I can handle, or I'm not sure I'm qualified for, because that still happens all the time. I just go, Marisa, bet on you, honey. Bet on you. Bet on you.
Mm.
And all the negative experiences, and that's part of the power of pivoting, is like all the negative experiences we have that we usually use to talk ourselves out of it, you can actually use to talk yourself into it. Like, I've overcome all of these
yes.
things. I got this. Not easy, but I got it. I have 100% success rate. Like I tell myself, this is me talking to myself. You have 100% success rate overcoming the things you thought you couldn't. You got this.
Yes. You just have to do one step at a time. I love that. Well, Marisa, thank you so much for coming to Café con Pam. And this was awesome. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, it's, you know, this has been such a wonderful experience and journey. And thank you for all the podcasts you do. I saw all the episodes you put out there and how varied they are. Everybody can find themselves in that. I think that's amazing. So thank you for the work that you do too.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, that's the goal, for everyone to find a model that they can see themselves reflected into. All right, listeners, that was my conversation with Marisa. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you're inspired, because I certainly was after my conversation with her. I certainly connected and resonated with a lot of the anecdotes that Marisa shared. And there's definitely lots to learn from. I would love to hear your thoughts. Tag me at Café con Pam Podcast on Instagram.
tell me what resonated with you. I love getting those. It's super fun. Also, you can drop a rating or a review in your podcast platform of choice. The two most popular that we use or that we see people use the most are Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And so let us know. And if this is your first time listening to Cafe con Pam, I really hope you return. I really hope you consider this place as a space where you can return at any moment when you want to get some inspiration. That's what a lot of people have told me recently, because we have over 350 episodes now, and there's always a story that will support you in whatever it is that you need in the moment. And what I love is when I hear people say, oh, I just like scroll and, you know, whatever my finger lands, that's the episode that I listen to. And somehow there's always a message there for me. That's like so cool. Thank you so much for being here. And for a quick update, this is the first episode after Cafe con Pam Live, and I'm still overfilled with so much joy. It was an incredible event. People came through, people flew, people drove, people came from the neighborhood. It was amazing. We truly enjoyed it. I had so much fun. It was a total dream come true to have me do a Cafe con Pam, like a kind of typical Cafe con Pam interview, and also to be able to extend it to the audience and be like, all right, what are your questions after you've heard me interview the guest? What do you think is the next question to ask? And like, y'all came through with the questions. It was amazing. Stay tuned for the episode. We did record it. It is going to be an episode. That's why it's called Cafe con Pam Live, because we did record it live and then it is set to release as an actual episode. So stay tuned for that. We'll give you deets about it. Y bueno, listeners, thank you so, so much for being here today. Como siempre, stay shining. Sabrosura, papi, que.